My name is Alan Walker. My date of birth is the 29th of April, 1943.
And how did you get started in hockey?
Well, my father was in the Navy, and we were moving backwards and forwards from Portsmouth to Darlington, which was where I was born. And eventually, in 1951, Dad had a shore job, and I came down to around the time of 9 or 10, getting close to 11 plus. I was in Fareham. I was being pushed by the parents to go to try and get a place at the grammar school. I got one. And I went to Price's School in Fareham, no longer in being, but it had been established in 1721, and it was being playing hockey in one of the three terms all that time. So it was a hockey school. And I played football in the first term, hockey in the second term, cricket in the third term. And I was probably better at hockey than I was at soccer. I was probably a better cricketer. However, I played hockey, and when I joined the Navy, leaving that school in January 1960, I very quickly gravitated from the second team football, where I was the goalie, to be the first team hockey player, because not many people played hockey, and the hockey teams got all the good trips, especially the first teams, and therefore that's something, you know, to look forward to. I learned to sing lots of naughty songs and play lots and lots of hockey all over Devon and Cornwall. And I left HMS Fiskard, where I joined in 1961 at Easter, went to Collingwood in Fareham in Hampshire, which was where, right alongside where I lived, my home. And within a term, after the first term at Collingwood, I was off to Dartmouth, because I said I'd like to be an officer, please. And they kicked me out after two terms. Sadly, it wasn't for anything tumultuous. It was just I had a problem with my eyes, and the scheme, I tended to see double because of a defect, and the scheme meant I could not be part of it and stand on the bridge of a ship at sea. So I went back to being an artificer apprentice and stayed on the lower deck for 13 years, and all that time I played hockey and cricket to excess. My first ship was HMS Albion in the Far East, and I joined her in, after 4 years ashore, I joined her in 1964 and took her out to, it was a commando carrier, took her out to the Far East, and we played lots of hockey out there, and I was the captain of the ship's team as a leading hand, a corporal equivalent. And I played for the Royal Navy in the Far East, and yeah, a bit of a treat, and moved in nice circles, lovely. Came back in 66 and continued on, and by then people were saying, hey, this chap is halfway decent hockey player. And I was in the Portsmouth command team, and I was trying to get in the Navy team, and eventually I just about made it, but I was right behind. In those days you only had 11 aside, and 11 aside meant that Bruce Trentham or Alan Walker would have the place in the team, and Bruce Trentham being the Olympian, he might well have got sent off at the Mexico Olympics in 68, but he was still big in Navy hockey. I mean, he was powerful too, and he used to even water ski behind Her Majesty's ships. They would let him do that because he was landed gentry, and he had that sort of influence. And Walker was, it was a case of every time the inter-services came along, sorry Alan, Bruce is available, and I played all the build-up games. And anyway, I was halfway decent player, but I was always in Bruce's shadow. And it was in about 68 that my heroes were a couple of chaps called Basil Middleton and Joe Binks. Now, these two both had started off lower deck hockey in the Navy, because it was always an officer sport, far more in the Navy than it ever was in the Army and the Air Force. I subsequently found that the Army had been playing other ranks and officers together ever since 1908. The RAF had been playing other ranks and officers together ever since 1918, 1920, that sort of time. The Navy persisted into the 50s, and any rating only played by invitation for the Navy team up to that point. But Joe Binks and Basil Middleton had changed all that. And that was the start. And they wanted very much to improve the coaching. And there were lots of coaches around There was a chap called Don Brownlee who was big in the South, and they followed on from others' examples at that time. And anyway, Basil became one of the first coaches in the military set up. He inspired Joe Binks, and Joe Binks was probably the most well-known sailor, hockey-playing sailor, in the whole of the three services. You could go to the north of England, you could go to Scotland, Ireland, anywhere else. Oh, how's Joe Binks getting on? Everybody knew Joe. He was a chief PDI, but very personable. And he'd played for Singapore in one of the Olympics, or somewhere around about 1956 or 58 or 60 or something like that. And he'd been a good player and he'd moved in good circles, but naval career messed it up really, and he never got the chance to take it further, although he was very proud of this being an Olympian, albeit for an adoptive type of country. Anyway, Joe and Basil gave me a personalised coaching course at HMS St Vincent, which had a long history of connection with the military, in 1968-69. Now, that was about 110 years since hockey had been started off in that establishment by the Royal Marines. And the Royal Marines Light Infantry had been based there for a long time, and an early secretary of hockey in Gosport, a founder club of Hampshire, had been a major in the Royal Marines Light Infantry from those barracks, representing Gosport. Anyway, that's another story, but it was significant that I had this special session just for me by these two my heroes in 68. I then went off to sea and I was a chief petty officer. I'd just been promoted, and lo and behold, I had to be in charge of all the other chief petty officers because I was a technocrat. I was a technician. The other chaps were, if you like, of a mechanic status, and the Navy was such that the technical person took precedence. And so I had to talk to all these chaps 10 and 15 years older than me and get them on side. I think I managed it, but anyway, I grew up a lot in 2 years in a little frigate, being in charge of all the electronics and all these old boys as well. And anyway, we had a very successful hockey team, and by the time I got back ashore to a military establishment in Gosport, which wasn't my first choice, but there was a funny story to that. Anyway, I got back to promoted after a year at teacher training college. And then I was promoted as a sub-lieutenant to HMS Sultan. Now, Sultan was full of stokers, and I knew lots about electrical and radio people and radar people, but stokers, down the hole, polishing shovels as far as I was concerned. But the minute I got there, they could see I was a bit green, and this chap said, "You ever been down the bleeding hole, sir?" And I said, "Well, actually, I'd punched a few sprayers in my time, being prepared for the question." This is something they do to get more steam. And anyway, I was ready for this, and these chaps turned out to be the salt of the earth, and I loved them to bits, and I had a wonderful job for 3 years. It turned out my boss was chairman of Navy Hockey, and he'd asked for me to go there and overruled my first choice of going to my alma mater, which was where I wanted to go and teach, because, you know, I'd taught there before and I thought, you know, better the place you know about. Anyway, this was wonderful. And during that time, I was appointed coach for the Navy Juniors, coach for the Navy Juniors Indoor, and coach for the Combined Services Juniors. And I took them to the first under 21 divisional tournament at Norwich in 75. And there built a relationship with the Army, the Navy and the Air Force that lasted till the present day. And so many of the Air Force and Army, you know, treat me like a god, and I'm not really. I just happened to be there on the first occasion, but they wine and dine me, invite me to stuff and things like that, and I'm a very lucky boy. But that's how I came to sort of be so well known within the services, because not only did I go for the junior teams, then it was the ladies teams and the senior men's team, and for 20 years, myself and Ian Jennings ran the best combined services team we'd ever had. Well, around that time too, the head of Navy Sport came along and said, "Look, I was one of those who influenced you to join the education branch, because there was a slot for one a year to come from the lower deck, and we thought you'd be the right bloke. But the way it's turned out, you've probably been placed at a disadvantage, because most of the guys in the branch who are going to the top have got 2 degrees. You haven't even got one. You've got an ONC or an HNC. In other words, you're a non-graduate in a branch full of graduates. So therefore, you're going to probably stay as a lieutenant commander. And how about coming working for me as a sports officer at HMS Temeraire, the headquarters of Navy Sport? And that was in 86. Well, he didn't quite say it like that. He said, come for interview. He said, I think you've got a good chance. He said, we're going to make it hockey and swimming, and you're Mr. Hockey. So left it like that. And as it happened, because I hadn't been to sea as an officer for 13 years, where they promised me 2 ships, I kept all my hockey hats. Usually you'd hand them in, you know, and you'd go to sea and you'd do what you had to do at sea, and then you'd come back and pick up where you left off, maybe. Well, I'd kept all my hats and built on them. So by now, I was the service's chief coach. And it was pointed out to me that if I wanted to go any further than the services, you better get some kids under your belt, because actually, there aren't too many kids in the Army and the Navy, and you need that in your CV. Okay, so Graham Chesterman, who was the very first not sports appointee, and not sports were even then keen in 86 to actually sell AstroTurf pitches to Hockey Association and AE. And as a result, they put some money, £300 a county, just about paid postage, into a development officer appointment in each county. And the trouble that the HA did not do was to tell Hampshire they're going to appoint me as the Hampshire man. And Mike Ward, as only Mike Ward can be, he got quite snotty about it, and, oh, well, thanks for telling Hampshire. And I said, well, with respect, I was, you know, doing as I was told, because I was doing things for the HA. Anyway, we healed the breach, and I ended up going to work at silly time in the morning, about 6 a.m, and finishing at 2, so that I could go to after school clubs, or form after school clubs, in Portsmouth, Fareham, Havant and Gosport. And that was during the period, late 80s. And a little kid came up to me, a little lad, and we'd had a smashing session in the playground in Gosport. And this little lad said, hey mister, he said, you're the hockey man. Why have I got to go to Fareham or over the ferry to Pompey to go and play hockey when you've brought hockey to us here? Why can't we have a hockey club in Gosport? And that rang a bell or two. So we formed a hockey club in Gosport. And cut a long story short, Gosport Borough helped us. They were quite keen in a way, because the cricket club had a running battle with rugby and football in the winter, ruining their outfield. And they said, how about getting into bed with the hockey club, and you come and join with us, and, you know, we'll look after you, use our pavilion. And there's a clubhouse. And anyway, that on the 10th of November, 90, we started restarted Gosport Borough Hockey Club, which had foundered. And it had foundered because of a teacher called John Law. A teacher called John Law, who'd actually come on a Navy course to complete his qualifications, and then proceeded to produce some wonderful children in what turned out to be one of the foremost hockey schools in England, Broome Park School in Gosport. And that was in the 70s. Now, that was the time when I was in HMS Sultan, and my adults always had trouble beating his kids. The Faulkners and all that lot were there. And anyway, what this John Law did, which was to the detriment of Gosport, hockey in Gosport, which had been there since 1898, was actually to take all the bright kids he'd got, including the Faulkners and everybody else, and take them off to Trojans, and some of them gravitated to Fareham and Havant and the rest of Hampshire. But they didn't figure in Gosport, because John Law hadn't seen much evidence of decent hockey going on in Gosport. And to be fair, I mean, it had foundered when he came along. He just filled a gap, and he took the kids elsewhere. And anyway, John, as you know, went on to be England under-16s, 18s and everything else, and sort of made his name. Me, in the meantime, had to go and get a CV, get kids on my CV. And so I got this this.
How different was it coaching children from coaching adults?
Well, it was very much getting the parents on side, first of all. And the first thing I did was, I tried to get. What happened was that effectively I'd gone along to Havant with my daughters, both of whom were just about ripe to play hockey, and that was the best club in the area as far as children were concerned. Now, the club coach was one Nigel Allfrey from somewhere around the Bisham Abbey area, but at the time he was the club coach of Gosport, and he asked me. He said, I'm just leaving the club. They want me to find a new person to relieve me and recommend somebody to take over from me. How about you? In fact, come here, Mr. Adams, you're the club captain or whatever it is, Alan Walker, he's your new club coach. How about it? I stayed for 10 years. However, first thing I did was say, right, let's have a session. Bring all the mums and dads along and all the children who are interested. And I had about 150. So I divided a pitch up into four. And we took a quarter of them there, quarter of them there, quarter of them there. And I had a bit in the middle. And I said, right, this is what we're going to do. And mums and dads, I want you to help where you can. And so what we did was actually give a demonstration in the middle. And I had a couple of helping coaches to do it. And they would, everything from holding the cones, bibs, just generally sort of supporting what was going on. And the children would play a little game, which was just like football, really, but you were playing with a stick and a ball and keeping it safe and all the rest of it. And I said, right, mums and dads, if your child is in that group, off you go, that group, off you go, that group, off you go. And they all went away and people thought this was wonderful. And they hadn't had that at Havant before in quite that way. And I thought, well, that's one way of handling all these people, because it was really a mass participation job. And bit by bit, that's how it sort of grew. And the first thing was getting the mums and dads on side. Yeah. And you'd get a mum who would say, would you like me to wash these bibs? They're getting them manky or they got a bit wet today. Oh, yes, please, yes. And would you mind bringing the cones along next time as well and keeping them for me? And yes, of course I can lend a stick to little Johnny or whatever it was, And bit by bit, a lot of people came on side, and a lot of mums and dads. And I was in a position, not like it is today, where you could actually say, right, mums and dads, here's a leader course, here's a little leaflet about it. And at the end of this session, you are a qualified Hockey Association or AEWHA leader. And I got the ladies on side as well. And they were leaders. And do you want to have a go at level one coach? And one or two did, and so on. And bit by bit, the Havant model spread, and we did it, elsewhere in Portsmouth. And, come the time, in 10th of November 90, we started Gosport. The other thing was, of course, that since 1968, when I went off to sea, I'd also had some time ashore when I'd said, yes, I want to go on that course, I want to go on this course. And I'd gone off to the ship's PTI had said to me in 1970, would you like to go on a course that's being run at an RAF place out in the sticks somewhere? It's for a coaching award, I think, but it's a week's hockey. Count me in, I said. He said, I'll get you a rail warrant. Got me a rail warrant. It turned out that it was to Royal Air Force Halton, and the course was an HA1 award course. And likely lads had been earmarked for this course, and Basil and Joe, my mentors, had actually said, yeah, but put him in. And I think they had something to do with the selection. Anyway, I went to RAF Halton and did this course and came out with an HA1. And the first thing I had to do was come back next year, same time, and be part of the examining board to run next year's course. And the course had been staffed by the RAF players from the previous year. And there was Cadman and Clark leading this lot from the front. And all the Navy guys were next year were all involved helping Clark and Cadman run this course in much the same way as I'd done this Havant thing years later. So it was just fabulous. And we then, myself and a chap called Jan Keel, we started running courses, and that's when John Law plugged into one, and lots of the Fareham coaches plugged into one. And we always needed a bank of coaches to stand by, because the military being the military, you say, right, we're going to have an HA1 course, we're going to have an HA2 course, whatever it was, we would want to have X amount of people to make it viable. And oh, so-and-so can't come because the ship sailed, or he's, you know, he's life in a blue suit stuff. So we were saying, Fareham, you got any people who want to do a coaching course? Oh yeah, Guy Lawson and Paul Jones will come along, or something like that. No, with the early one, Mick Christopher was another one who was still going strong up to a few years ago. And you know, the people would jump in left, right and Chelsea, and of course they were eternally grateful to us, because A, it was a cheaper course, and B, you know, we'd suddenly given them a chance, and that was setting them up on the coaching ladder. So when it came to forming Gosport, and you said, hey chaps, any chance of a bit of help, people would come along, and all the local clubs would say, yeah, sure, you know, half the club, the people in our club are your coaches, you know, we'll help. And so there was a mutual admiration society, in a way that people just bounced off, yes, fine, let's, we'll help. And you know, that's how it all came about.
And a lot of that was to plug this gap in your CV. So what did you do after that when you plugged the gap?
Well, once I'd plugged the gap, I was the development officer, and I very much was a prime mover in not so much Fareham, but I did lots of schools in Fareham, but some of the kids from the schools from Fareham came to Gosport, and they helped us become national champions indoor, particularly us Gosport. Tickling here. Havant, I stayed with Havant, and they wanted me to. Oh, it was towards the end of the... they knew that I'd been the manager of England under-21s from 92. Papin apparently had been asked and hadn't been able to continue beyond a certain point. And Papin had been asked in about 90, and he'd said, sort of said, yes, and then it didn't quite work out. Anyway... I was asked to be the manager in 92, from 92 onwards, and they were into a build-up to the 93 European Cup, and I got involved and stayed involved until after the World Cup in 93. And during that time, we had had the World Cup in 93 was some August September time 93. We'd gone to represent England at senior level. What had happened was the Indira Gandhi Memorial Tournament was going to be January 93. For some reason or other, it was cancelled, and it was changed to March 93. And there was the only way we could send an England team was to badge up the juniors. Now, the juniors were seen as, most of them, likely Olympians. So they badged them up, all of us, and off we went to Bombay on about the 12th or 13th of May. I think it was Friday the 13th of May, we actually got bombed out of the hotel, but we came home on the 15th and got back to England on the 16th, the wrong way round.
When you got bombed out of the hotel, talk me through what happened.
Well, we arrived on, I think it was Friday the 13th, it might have been the 12th, and we had a stretching and training session, but it was very much a physical thing with the doctor and with the physio, and we went back to the hotel, and Whitaker, myself and Martin Rogers decided that we'd have a team meeting and you know, we'd meet in Whitaker's room. So there was an L-shaped hotel like this. My room was in this bit, Whitaker's bit was in that bit. We met in here. Martin Rogers was sitting on the bed facing the window out of here, and the pool was over there 75 yards where all the boys were. Now my room was here, and the bomb was in a suitcase 3 floors above, and it directly straight down, and the bed was full of 3 foot shards of glass. Martin Rogers, how he ever, you know, how he missed his bits and pieces, I don't know, but he had something like two here, one there and one there, literally facing
two
the window, shards of glass.
I'll say this for the tape, two between his legs, one either side.
Yes, shards of glass.
So
how it missed him.
A bit like a knife thrower.
Indeed, indeed. It was just like, just as if it happened. But nothing. It didn't even cut his trousers. Just unbelievable. But anyway, this thing had gone off, and we then got together with all the Indira Gandhi people, and this chap came along, and he was obviously spokesman for the Indira Gandhi tournament, and he said, "Well, let me talk first." And he said, "Only bombs on Fridays, no bombs on Saturdays, no bombs on Sundays, no bombs on Mondays." And we said, "Yeah, pull the other one." I said, can you guarantee our security?" And the French and the, you know, several others were saying the same thing. We had all the sort of pennants, you know, to present and everything else. I still got them. And I thought, they'll come in handy for the museum one day. Anyway, the net effect was that this chap could not really guarantee. They talked about for a little while for an armed guard, but in the end we decided, and it was a collective decision of all of us, and there were, I don't know, the usual 8 or 12 teams there, and we decided that we knew by then several things. We knew that there had been 13 explosions that Friday afternoon across Bombay. We knew that 208 people had been reported killed. This was in 93, don't forget, before some of this other stuff that's happened subsequently. Anyway, we'd seen graphic images in the newspapers, and they don't pull their punches. If there's a headless body with no arms, they'll show it in the paper, and it's awful. Anyway, we decided collectively that we had to go. But everybody was saying, "We've got to get out of here. We don't know what's got happening. We don't know what's going on at all. We don't know who's responsible for this." I've subsequently found bits and pieces, but we were then said, "Right, okay, let's try and get out." And I was talking to Sky TV. I was talking to Mike Hamilton back at home, and Mike had been seen off, in my opinion, because all of a sudden Whittaker had come in from the cold and been appointed instead of Mike. And Mike had been with these boys ever since they were 14, 16, 18. And then there they are in the year of the World Cup, and all of a sudden Whittaker's put in. And Ian Forster was the chairman of the HA at the time. And it was 93, so we hadn't yet joined up forces. It wasn't joint men and women yet. And I said, "Look, what are you doing to Mike? You can't do this." And I was the manager, was in charge of the team in those days. I said, "You really can't. I mean, that really is a false move. Despite Whittaker's reputation, get him on board by any means, but don't depose Mike." And all he would say is, "My dear Alan," and of course he was an ex-group captain RAF, Air Commodore, excuse me, and he said, "My dear Alan, you don't know half of it, and I'm not proposing to tell you." And I thought, well, thanks very much for the vote of confidence, you know. Yeah. But I was desperately disappointed at that. However, I had worshipped the ground Whittaker walked on ever since 86. I'd been the England's video man with Mike up the stick at all 42 games at Wilson. And at the end of the 42 games, Mike had already had an England tracksuit. Whittaker came up carrying this England tracksuit and presented it to me up in the nest at the end of the last game. After, you know, they lost to Australia in the final. And, you know, absolutely wonderful. But made my day. And, of course, I just bowed down and worshipped Whittaker ever since. But I did feel for Mike, and I still do. I think.
So how long did it take you to get the team out of Bombay?
Yeah, well, the problem was that everybody was trying to get the hell out. And in the end, we liaised via Mike and Debbie at the HA, Debbie Smith, and we got a flight on the Sunday where this had happened on the Monday. So we had to stick around for best part of 48 hours, certainly 36 hours or more. And we had to then fly to Hong Kong the wrong way to get a flight to go from Hong Kong to England. And we arrived at about 4 or 5 in the morning on the Monday morning, which would be about, I guess, 16th, something like that, of March, 93. So that was pretty hairy. But we got them all back in one piece. And I like to think that, you know, because of my naval background, there was an element of, you know, I was pleased with my performance. I think I don't think I did too much wrong there, and I felt the important thing was that I knew all these lads' mums and dads, and after all, they were under 21s, and some of them were 18 or 19, getting their first run, and
a shocking experience for them.
It was, yeah. But I mean, apart from a couple of classes, Gibbons I think got a cut arm, Matt, lad from Birmingham Uni, his mum Sue Sutton, Matt Sutton, he had another scratch as well. But apart from that, they were with the doctor in the pool anyway.
It
could have been, yeah, yeah.
After that, what was your role?
Well, my role then, I had done a total of 57 matches for the under 21s against somebody, mostly countries, although we did have a couple of games against my combined services with Jennings in, and my Jennings team beat them once. But anyway, that was another thing. But I also had 4 HA games, and I let it be known that I would love to continue. And John Royce, we decided around that time, after the World Cup, that henceforth coaches would be, the organisation of teams would be coach-led, and still as it is today. And the manager would be very much second to the coach, where I'd been in charge. I was the last one to be in charge. And to be fair, my team had been fifth in the World Cup. My team and Whittaker's team, coming fifth in the World Cup, we had the most successful under 21 team record in a World Cup ever for 4 years. But then Royce came along with Chris Pickett and beat it by coming fourth in 97 in Milton Keynes. And I was just unceremoniously dumped. Not least because John Royce said to me, "I think you're the best in the business, Alan," he said. And John had been picked as the coach to follow on. And he said, "Can we meet?" And I said, yes, sure. We got up to a pub in Hindhead, halfway between South Coast. And he said, "Right," he said, "I do think you're the best in the business. I'd like you to be my assistant coach." No, assistant manager. And I said, "Oh, well, having been the manager for 2.5 years, at least, 2 years and 8 months or something, you want me to be the assistant manager?" He said, "Yeah, there's nobody better with balls and cones and bottles and bibs and ice." "Thanks, John, that's bloody good of you." Anyway, he had not been on that trip to Bombay, by the way, or he hadn't been part of much. Occasionally he'd flit in and out and, be John, as John Moores was John. You know, not unlike Gavin in many ways. But anyway, it was... I said, "Look, thank you very much." I said, "But who do you want for this?" He said, "I'm going to ask Mallett."
Neil Mallett.
"I'm going to ask Neil Mallett to be the manager." Oh, I said, "Well, good luck to you then." I said, "But please count me out." I said, "I'll be the manager for 2.5 years. I'll stick with that. Thank you very much. Count me out." And I basically stood down. Although I let it be known that if it didn't happen, then I was still up for it. I was interested if the manager job ever became, because I knew that Neil had also got a bit of history with the HA, and it might not go down in all quarters. Anyway, it didn't go down with all quarters, and Neil never got approval or whatever. However, Pickett got approval. And Peter Sharp rang me up, who was the chairman of selectors, and he was father of the Sharp who was in my England juniors team. And he said, "I'm sure you'll join with me in congratulating Chris on his appointment." And I said, "Of course I will, yes." Desperately disappointed. And I thought, "Well, yeah, okay." So I'm out. And I've been of the opinion ever since that, I was dumped. And I felt I didn't really deserve to be dumped, but, and having talked to one or two other people in years gone by, I think the HA is too big in some cases to actually go through all the niceties, where you'd like to say, well, if somebody just said, "Thanks, cheers a bunch," or whatever, but it wasn't much. I mean, the odd one person who was probably important said, "Thanks, Alan," but, I mean, as a general overview, I was not consigned to the annals of history in any way other than, was a manager for 2.5 years, and that was it. But it was dumped and I left it like that, really. Funnily old thing, I'd been part of the JIG, which was a joint initiative group between the coaches of the men and the women. And a year later, I was asked to be, when the two associations got together, not least because the Sports Council made it so, by virtue of putting conditions on the money, I was the first chair of the National Coaching Committee. And so all the coaches, including Mike Hamilton and people, were working for me. And then there was a sort of, there was a Chris Spice bit, and there was a, what was the lady called? I've forgotten her name now, but anyway, a lady came along as a chief coach too, or a development, head development officer. Trish someone? No, maybe not Trish. But anyway, someone followed Chris Spice. But to be fair then, we were going along, and I thought I was doing a reasonable job, and you know, coaching seemed to be okay, but there didn't seem to be much money around. And John Wyatt, his dad was the top man in England hockey at the time. He'd got the chairman job or whatever. He was working for Mon, so Mon must have been the president, and he'd be the chairman, I think. And anyway, something happened, and the money seemed to dry up, and all of a sudden, the EHA, which had come into being when Jointery arrived, the EHA went down the pan in about 2002-03, and then of course that chap with all the money from Brighton Hockey Club or somewhere along there sort of lent us £500,000 of his own money and sort of got us out of the poo, as it were. And with that, a whole new stuff, load of people arose, and that was the end of me, really. Chairman of coaching became a thing of the past, and other people took it on and took it for onward and upward, I suppose. So I guess, to some extent, because we were part of that which went down the pan, I don't think there was any blame attached to us as such. However, that was the end of it.
I think it was the clean sweep.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, whatever. I mean, I had quite enough to do. Were pushing me to play, come, we'll give you £6,000 to be part-time club coach. Gosport wanted more and more and more from me. US Portsmouth had made me a vice president yonks earlier and there was an admiral at my elbow saying, "Alan, don't forget who it is that pays your mortgage, and we've got a centenary coming up and you're going to have to bloody write something." Hence that book.
Tell me, what's the book called?
Well, it's out there on the table, and it's called The Centenary of Navy Hockey, I think, or something like that. 100 Years of Navy Hockey, something like that, I can't remember. But there's several copies out there for anyone to take away. But I was the Secretary of Navy Hockey, and I had been from 86. My last job, which could have been in uniform, was not in uniform. It was up the stick at Wilson on my pre-release vocational training course, because they paid me to go live in London and do that job. And get some experience with England hockey. I could choose my own course, if you like, and that was my course. Interestingly, along the way, I found that Royal Air Force Halton had always been special to me. My granddad had been a headhunted head gardener back there in 1898, when it was owned by Lord Posh Houses, posh fella from Germany. Anyway, this chap donated Halton House to the Royal Air Force after World War One. About 1923, it became the headquarters. But my granddad had worked there in the 1890s. Lord. My God, what was it? And there, I've gone to this course in 1970, not knowing that my granddad had been there 80 years later, or earlier rather. Yes, and that's why I said to you, before you dragged me in here, I was saying about coincidences, and it was that, you know, life is just full of coincidences. The fact that the other day they honoured me as the person who founded Gosport Hockey Club, but actually I didn't. I flitted in and out of St Vincent and that area, which has been going for about 180 years, and you know, another coincidence. And Gaynor next door, who's one of the hockey makers, and she's now the club's liaison officer for the south of England, several counties, and she was her who opened up this morning. She is you know, one of my protege, really. I mean, she's following in my footsteps. When I helped to start Gosport, she was along within 6 months. And if there's anybody like the old big dog in the Tom and Jerry movies, you know, the one who pats his little lad on the head and says, "That's my boy." Well, that's my girl. And she's, yeah. And now she's, you know, she's doing going the same sort of route as I did. And she's leaping up and down to Bisham Abbey every day of the week. And, poor girl. And she's a mum.
So what are you doing now with hockey?
Well, I'm a vice president of lots of clubs. I'm a vice president of Royal Navy Hockey, Armed Forces Hockey, Nordics Hockey, US Portsmouth Hockey, Gosport Hockey. So that's about five clubs or associations. They all wheel me out on high days and holidays. To do this or that. I've recently helped the Nordics, which is a sort of play by invitation. There were a lot of the old boys who I knew years ago who had gone through the World War II just looking forward to a bit of cricket, bit of hockey, green fields of England and all that, you know, getting home and just putting the desert and all the rest of it to bed. And when a lot of like-minded people of that time got together in 1951, and women's hockey had just started in 47, 51, women's hockey representative, Army, Navy, Air Force, this 51 was all the people who'd been continuing to play combined services hockey. Many of them had played before the war. They were continuing on hockey as it should be played, you know, in the gracious era where, you know, everyone was friends, you knew them all. It was the cricket sweater and cravat type era, the long stick and you know, several beers in the pavilion with old friends, wonderful stuff. Never mind the, you know, I think people could see that hockey was going to become more serious and maybe a bit nastier. But we Nordics would keep this thing going. And they called themselves the United All Services Hockey Club, but that became a bit of a rallying cry, but it got confused with the United Services Portsmouth Hockey Club, which had started back in 1902. And so they said, well, we tend to sort of play all over the place, and we're going up to the north for a little tour now. Well, let's call ourselves the Nordics. So they called themselves the Nordics, and they've been going since 51. And it's still a gentlemanly... And in fact, I'm pushing them like mad, because 16-17, the season about to start, it's the 70th anniversary of women's hockey being played at inter-service level. And the women don't seem in the slightest bit interested. And, you know, I'm trying to sort of persuade some of the old girls to step out, and us men have identified some of these people who should be vice presidents, life members, associate members, whatever. They should have some role in the game, some title. Don't have to do anything, just front up on important days. But you don't seem in the least bit bothered. It's sad. But maybe I heard from Mike that a couple of RAF girls had been pushed by the RAF chairman, and I've been banging in his ear for a while now to say, look, the RAF started after the Navy and the Army, and it's your 100 years coming up in 1918-19 season, or if you want to be fair, it's the 1919-20 season when you played the first inter-service matches of the RAF. You should have get ready now and start making a fuss. And I think these two girls who came in here during this fortnight have actually talked to Mike and said, what about RAF hockey? And Mike said, who? And we've been told to write something on RAF ladies hockey. So he said he'd put them on to me, but he hasn't done so yet. Or by the time I come up here, I haven't. But anyway, I'm trying to keep abreast of RAF and Army at the same time. But, you know, I've got quite enough to do with it. And of course, with this recent rubbish with cancer and stuff, I'm sort of, you know, trying to get that out of the way. I'm believing the best that they they're telling me, which is actually that they can probably control this, all being well. But I got to find out on the 15th of July for sure.
And do you still enjoy watching hockey?
Yeah, I do. I spent several days last week watching hockey. And I make a point of trying to, particularly in the Royal Naval environment or the Army or the US Portsmouth or anybody really, whichever team is along, I like to meet the new people and say, "Hi, I'm Ellen Walker. That's my name on the pitch gate up there," or something like that. You know, been around a week or two. I'm the bloke who writes in the Navy News. You know, I'm the chap who sends things to the Royal Air Force News, and they don't take any notice. But you know, that's probably because it's a naval person writing for an RAF magazine. But whatever, I try and do my bit for services hockey. They having honoured me, they've taken me to dinners, they've taken me to, you know, this, that and the other thing really, and I'm just treated like a leg end, and you know, I'm determined not to be a John Gawley, who's a bit of a lonely leg end, I think.
Well, you earn the title a legend because you've done so much for Navy hockey and services hockey.
Well, I mean, I've just been a boring bastard, yeah. That's all.
No. It's been a great delight hearing all about it. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for saying so. But, I mean, it's probably dead boring.